compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, Lunger, let's do it. Okay, so Dr. Janet Smith, until just recently, I believe, she may have retired, but she was teaching moral theology at the Sacred Heart Seminary in Detroit. And she has an article, it's in Crisis Magazine, called The Limits of a Priest's Right to Privacy. And she adverts to the situation that I was just describing about the high-ranking official at the U.S. Bishops' Conference who resigned suddenly because it was shown that his phone and the phone data, as well as the a particular app or two that he had on his phone that are designed to get people to hook up with each other. And it showed just this insane activity going on 2018, 2019, 2020. You can read the article. Thepillar.com has got the most comprehensive article on this topic. You can check it out there if you want all the nitty gritty. So what Dr. Janet Smith takes up then is the question that sort of arises from this story, and that is, what are the limits of a priest's right to privacy? She says in the case of this particular priest, he shouldn't be surprised that such data can be collected, since those who use these apps must consent to having their movements traced. Such apps store information about the users, information that can be purchased often to target people for marketing purposes. Some are suggesting, she says, that data used by the Pillar was gained immorally. They argue that to do so is to violate some putative right to privacy. They seem to see the use of such data as a form of detraction insofar as it is making public information, even when true, that should remain private. Yet I see, she says, no reason to speculate that such was the case. It is not detraction, she says. Of course, to disclose, to disclose true and damaging information about someone to someone else who has legitimate reasons to know that information. For example, an employee embezzling funds, or a wife or a husband committing adultery or using drugs or squandering the family's finances. Certainly a bishop has a legitimate reason to know the information about his priests, and so too, in my mind, she says, does anyone who is entrusting their immortal soul to guidance by a priest. Dioceses are supposed to do periodic audits of diocesan offices and parishes to discover whether there has been any misappropriation of funds. They look through all the data and report any clearly wrong or suspicious use of funds. People can and do go to jail based on such information. We just had an example of a Catholic university out west who was the CFO, and he was found to have bilked the university out of millions and millions of dollars. So this kind of stuff does go on, obviously. She says companies use programs to determine if their employees are looking at porn or even shopping on company time. They often will fire employees who do so, since they are effectively stealing from the company. Surely, such data collection is a necessary form of accountability or due diligence. Is abuse of funds a more serious offense than the abuse of people? Does one's sexual life come with a zone of privacy? Well, yes, in some places and times, but for those who have pledged a life of chastity in helping form others in chastity? The church itself, in fact, uses data collection and surveillance methods to police the sexual lives of priests and seminarians. Seminarians have filters on computers to catch students and faculty, lay and priests, and staff who may view pornography. The consequences can be very serious, including dismissal from the seminary or losing one's job. Dioceses seize the computers and phones of priests accused of wrongdoing, especially sexual, to find evidence for their wrongdoing, such as the use of pornography. Dioceses even use the services of local law enforcement agencies when they investigate priests for wrongdoing. There are surveillance cameras in many places these days. Some think they should be in sacristies to see if priests are, and she gets into, you know, possible malfeasance. Would that be wrong, she asks. If a surveillance camera in a church or a church building recorded some sort of immoral activity, should that not be reported to the bishop? But the counterargument goes, shouldn't a priest's private life be his private life? She says, really? Again, priests are made to be models and guardians of chastity. What does it do to a priest? And I'm going to have to skip over some aspects of this article because some of it is, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just a bit unseemly to discuss on the air. So I'll leave those passages aside and I'll just cover a few more of the highlights. She says, another reason that bishops would want to know what immoral activity a priest was engaged in is that the whole diocese is liable for their behavior, for the abuse of both minors and the vulnerable. And even when there is no civil law against certain kinds of immorality, the cost of scandal when it comes out is serious. People leave or won't join a church that harbors priests who do such things. And then she finishes with this very interesting question. She says, finally, shouldn't the bishops welcome this data? Referring here to the priest who had to step down from the USCCB, she says, he has a bishop who is his spiritual father. His soul is in mortal danger. His father should want to know what he is doing and help him stop and recommit himself to a chaste life. For let's not forget, this is all about souls. Whoever thought we'd be dealing with issues like this? I think a lot of this is, of course, due to the rise of technology, this dizzying rise in the capability of technology surveilling everything at every moment. I never thought I'd live to see a world like the one we live in now, but here we are. So rather than think about how we wish things could be or should be, we have to deal with them the way they are, it seems to me. So that's why an article like that, which I never thought I'd ever read, now makes sense. And you can get that article in its entirety by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Cyrus will have a link to it for you. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Brian in Riverside, California. Hi, Brian.
I just wanted to say, our quick comment on your thoughts, or wanted to ask, it really seems like morality is going to backslide right now. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. For example, I mean, if we were in a Star Wars movie, I think we're at the point where Yoda's getting on the ship to go into exile because all the religious Jedis are dying. So I just wanted to ask, knowing this, I mean, traditionally, religious, you know, pious, you know, folks have leaned on the Republican Party to, you know, further, you know, morality surrounding things like abortion. Some of the political commentators I listened to mentioned that, you know, everything appears to slide a little more to the left each election cycle. What are we going to do when suddenly the Republican Party, in order to stay current, now says, well, we're, you know, we don't like abortion, but it's okay for rape and incest. I will fight to the death for rape and incest. Or, you know, we're not for child sex changes, but, you know, we're absolutely for, you know, hormone blockers on children. Mm-hmm. But, of course, no further than that. Well, what's going to happen when it gets to that point, when the Republican Party, in order to stay current, takes some of its religious, you know, morality and shelves it as a more secular and youthful society who doesn't really have any interest in religion, you know, moves forward?
Okay. When you say, what are we going to do? Do you mean, what are we going to do when it comes time for elections, or what specifically?
Yeah, elections. Like, what do you do election cycles? So now, you know, basically what's going to happen when the only truly moral route is to opt out entirely of elections versus, you know, well, at least I have one party that has a chance of winning.
Yeah. Yeah. So if things deteriorate beyond where they've already deteriorated to, I would say if you don't have a viable option to vote for, then abstain. I mean, I've been in that situation before, and that's what I've done in conscience, in principle. I've just said I cannot vote for either candidate, so I'm going to abstain. I wish I didn't have to, but I'm going to abstain. I've done that before. So that would be one, just from my own personal experience, that would be one. But I must say, I certainly do not look to the Republican Party for moral advice or moral example. I mean, they're politicians. They're trying to get elected and stay in power, and they may personally espouse some of these principles. I don't know. It seems like some do. But I think many of them, they realize that they can be successful with their constituents if they at least mouth certain ideas, even though if they don't really believe in them. And then that usually comes out in the wash when they get into office and they never really follow through on some of these things. So I don't look to either political party. Certainly not the Democratic Party, and nor do I look to the Republican Party for any moral guidance or leadership at all. Rather, I look to Jesus, to the church. And, you know, when you say, what are we going to do? I hear you, and I understand the dilemma that you're raising. It's a real dilemma. I understand it. So for me personally, what am I going to do? Well, I try to take to heart what it says in Hebrews chapter 12. So in verse 1, it says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses," referring to the Old Testament saints, "let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." So I see that as sort of the blueprint of what we should do in any circumstance, ultimately look to Jesus and stay close to him. And all the more so if we see a general collapse of morals and mores in our society. It's happened before. We're not the first ones to live through it. But I certainly don't look to the politicians for, you know, what to do next. I think the next thing to do is, you know, if you have to abstain, abstain. That's how I look at it, Brian. What do you think?
Well said. Truth be told, I'm already there personally, although I will say, you know, for example, last election cycle, I actually didn't choose one for, you know, either president. But now I feel mildly guilty just because of, you know, where we're at culturally. It's really hard to see some of the stuff that is being pushed and fought for. And I think it's going to get worse regardless. And, you know, I wonder what's going to happen. So that thanks for, you know, your thoughts.
You're welcome, Brian. You're welcome. Yeah, we're all in this together. That's for sure. So again, my advice, everybody, keep your eyes fixed on Christ. Know the truth. As Jesus says, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And if you know the truth and live according to the truth, it's going to be okay. It may be very difficult, may be very perilous. It may be very frightening at times. Jesus said, "In the world, you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world." Or as I've quoted so many times, Jesus said, "The wise man is the one who hears these words of mine and does them. He is like a man who built his house on a rock." And he describes how the wind and the rain and the floods burst against that house, but it does not fall, he says, because it has been built solidly on the rock. So I believe at every turn, Jesus is giving us the answer to the very good questions, like the one that you just heard from the caller. What do you do if it gets so bad that you maybe can't even vote in an election? What do you do? Well, Jesus gives us the answer. Stay on that rock, stay close to him, know the faith, live it and love it, be close to Jesus. And if you're doing those things, you know, in the abstract at least, sure, it can be very harrowing at times to see what goes on. You know, we have it relatively easy by comparison to what our brothers and sisters are going through in places like China and Saudi Arabia and Africa. A lot of the places where Christians are hacked to death or blown up in church at mass or shot and many other terrible things. We don't have that here. Let's hope we never do. So we also have to keep things in perspective and recognize that to us, what seems like, oh my gosh, this is the end of the world, it's not that bad compared to how many other terrible things are going on that Christians and others are suffering with around the world. So I like to try to keep that in perspective. That helps me, you know. And then, of course, as I've said before, this is no secret, but we're not alive here and now by accident. God has a plan for your life. He wants you to be alive right now. He has a reason for you being here now. And that's why I always feel like no matter what the headlines may say, this is a great time to be a Catholic. This is a great time. This is the best of times to be Catholic, to be a follower of Jesus. What better time could there be than a time of crisis? Because the church was built for crises. The church was built for these situations. And you yourself as a follower of Jesus, that's what you're called to. So it's like, you know, imagine if you had trained and trained and trained and you went to the academy and you became a fireman and you're assigned to your firehouse. And all you do day after day is play dominoes or watch TV or do crossword puzzles because there are no fires. And you never get called to do anything. You never get on the truck. You never uncoil a hose. You never put out a fire because there are no fires. And you just sit in that firehouse all day long doing nothing. That's not why you became a fireman, is it? So even though it's not a perfect analogy, I see something similar here, that by virtue of our baptism and our confirmation and our incorporation into the body of Christ sacramentally and in the church, that prepares us to do the things that need to be done in a world that is on fire. There's no lack of fires to put out in this world, as you know. So yes, this is a great, great, great time to be a Catholic. I'm grateful. And who knows what we'll live to see. time will tell and God knows. But that's my personal plan of action when it comes to moving forward. And I offer that to you for your consideration. Let us go now to Charles in Roswell, New Mexico. Hi, Charles. Seen any UFOs lately? Haha, just asking. Just kidding.
Yeah. One right out here. Let's see, right over there across the street, yeah. Patrick, you're the perfect person to ask the question to that I've got for a couple reasons. One, on the air, you said that you don't take your smartphone into confession.
Right.
And the second reason is that I understand that you understand quite well your telephone, but you know it better, your smartphone, better than the average person does. And from what little I understand, which I understand very little because I have no cell phone, smartphone, computer, nothing. But from all that I kind of envy you.
I must admit, Charles, I kind of envy you that. I wish I could get my life back to that, but it's impossible now. But anyway, go ahead.
Now, you're sucked in. I stepped out for spiritual reasons in 1993. Yeah. At any rate, from what I understand, the microphone can't be shut off. So do you think that something needs to be done to get priests to not take their smartphone into the confessional?
Interesting question. It could be mandated by the bishop if he felt that it was that big of a problem. I don't know that all priests bring their phones into the confessional. I'm guessing they probably do because they're like anyone else. You have your phone on you all the time. But if, let's say in the backdrop of this story about the priest who had to step down because of the bad apps that were on his phone and everything that came out of that, if this story gets bigger, and I suspect it will, and I have a feeling it's probably going to engulf more people before it's over, I wouldn't be surprised if it rose to that level of concern that bishops were to tell the priests, don't bring your smartphones into the confessional. I could see wisdom in that move. I just don't know, you know, whether it will get to that proportion or not.
Patrick, please bring this issue up as much as possible. We're at the very beginning of it, and you have the microphone.
Well, I don't take that lightheartedly. I take it to heart, I should say, and I don't take it for granted. So please pray for me, Charles. I would sure appreciate that. I don't want to be the minister of doom and gloom. I don't want to be that guy who's always talking about negative things. I don't like to have to deal with these stories. But as you say, these are big issues, and they're getting bigger. So we have to talk about them, unfortunately. Well, thank you, Charles. I appreciate it.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you. You know, as long as we're on that point, I just want to share with you something that happened on this program a few years ago. We were talking about this story, as we have done many times over the last, I don't know, 8 or 10 years, however long I've been doing this program. We've talked about this issue of technology and how it's gaining ground and how it surveils you and all these things. We've talked about it any number of times. Well, one day on this show, I happened to be talking about this, and I was reading a report from the Wall Street Journal or something like that. And after that segment, a call came in from a woman who asked a totally unrelated question. She asked me what I thought the church's position would be on cosmetic surgery to remove excess skin, because in the case of somebody who loses a huge amount of weight, maybe they get the gastric band on their stomach and whatever they do, and they lose a whole bunch of weight. She says, what about people who have like lots and lots of excess skin? Would it be problematic morally to have cosmetic surgery to remove the excess skin? And I had never been asked that question before. I'd never even thought about that question before. So I gave her my answer, and okay, and off we went. We continue with the show. Well, maybe 15 minutes go by, and a lady from a different part of the country calls up, and she says, oh my gosh, she says, Patrick, what you were talking about earlier about cell phone surveillance and how the phones listen, she said, I just had a really spooky experience that proved to me that what you're saying is true. I said, well, what happened? She said, I'm listening to your program, just listening to the program, and I heard that call. The lady asked about excess skin removal, and she says, I'm slim and trim. I have no need of that. I've never looked for anything like that on my browser. I've never even really heard about it before. And she said within 10 minutes, maybe less than that, she says her phone, you know, the browser on her phone started serving up ads for what? For excess skin removal. The kind of thing that very, very, very few people need. Suddenly now her browser on her phone was serving up ads for excess skin removal. Now, how does that happen if the phone is not listening to what's being said? I ask you that. Do you remember that, Cyrus? Wasn't that spooky
when she called in and told us that? Yeah, and I've heard other stories very similar. And, you know, it happens. My wife's told me about, you know, having a conversation, and then she goes to Facebook, and there's ads for what we just talked about in the feed.
I had my father's my mom and dad both are elderly. My dad will be 84, I believe, on his birthday this year. I should know that. I'm sorry. I think my dad's turning 84. And at some point, this is going back a few years, at some point, it seemed as though maybe he might need to get a couple of tooth implants. So without even really thinking about it one way or the other, I looked on my phone, on the browser on my phone, and I started looking at like, well, what does it cost to get a tooth implant, or, you know, multiples? And I didn't think anything of it. From that point forward, it seemed like for the next year or two, I was constantly getting ads for tooth implants. Now, that wasn't something that my phone heard, but that information was stored in enough places, I guess, so that every time I went on the internet after that, it's serving up ads for that. So, I mean, it's technological. We have the means to do
that. I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
And what is that problem, Dave?
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
I called you Dave. I should have called you Hal. Yeah. Okay, well, that's all. Just wanted to brighten everyone's day. Yay. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more right after this. 888-914-9149.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and RelevantRadio.com.
Cyrus, you ever apply for a job and you never heard back from the company? They just, you sent your resume in or whatever and you just never heard back?
Yes, I have. Matter of fact.
Well, don't be surprised.
I never heard back from Relevant Radio. I just kind of showed up, started pushing buttons, and they let me stay here.
Is it like George Costanza? Oh, no, that was Kramer. Where he kept
Milton
reporting to work.
Yeah, that's Milton. And Office Space.
Oh, I'm thinking about Seinfeld. But anyway, how about this? There are people now who are, because the labor shortage is so acute now in so many companies, especially in the service industry, hotels, restaurants, especially fast food, grocery stores and such, they can't hire people because the people are not applying for jobs. So the Wall Street Journal has got a fascinating article about how companies are getting back to people who sent them applications years ago and they never responded and nothing ever happened. So they're getting back to those people now and they're saying, hey, we got a job for you. Would you like to work for us? And they give a bunch of examples of people getting messages from White Castle, from Cracker Barrel, from a bunch of different companies because they're that desperate to try to find people to work. One of the fascinating aspects of the article, it says here, in the labor market of 2021, recruiters are the new telemarketers and job ads are the new spam. In recent months, as the economy has reopened, millions of U.S. workers have found themselves besieged by unlikely suitors, including companies that spurned them with no reply years ago. For workers, that has meant bemusement and in some cases, a dose of schadenfreude as well. In Arcadia, California, Joseph Guerrero, 23, says he was puzzled to receive a recent call from a manager calling on behalf of a local cheesecake factory. He says, I knew I didn't leave my wallet behind. He's now working as a case intake worker at a law firm. He says he hasn't been to Cheesecake Factory in years. The manager said they had received his application and wondered when he could come in for an interview to be a server. And he says, oh, I was like, thank you, but I found another job. He says that was 2 years ago when he applied to Cheesecake Factory. But they're that desperate. So, you know, did you ever apply to Cheesecake Factory, Cyrus?
As a matter of fact, I did, and I never heard back from him. But maybe that's what that call was to me this
check
morning.
Check your email.
Yeah, check my email.
Check your email.
You know, this is an interesting story because we've been talking about nobody wants to go back to work. But on an opposite side of that, and we haven't talked about this. This is the first I've mentioned it to you. My son has been looking for a job for the last month, and he's applied to all of these places that we've talked about, and no one has gotten back to him. He is young, you know.
That's
He's young. But I would have thought with the amount of, oh, we need workers and no one wants to work, no one is getting back to my
I'm guessing my kid. It's because he's not 18 yet.
And that's what my guess is too. Yeah. And that's what I told him. It's like, you know, you'll be lucky for someone to pick you up, but keep trying.
Well, if once he turns 18, though, if this problem persists, I have a feeling he'll be besieged with offers.
Mm-hmm. Well, he'll probably be getting calls from his applications now when he's 18. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah, so future him will be getting job offers in a few years for things that he's applying for. Now, check this out. Some companies say the strategy is just getting bites. In May, hamburger chain White Castle, which reduced its hours in certain locations because of limited staff, they sent out 550,000 emails. They sent emails to 550,000 previous applicants going back to 2017 to see if they could get some of those people to come to work at White Castle. Of that 550,000, 32,000 responded saying that they were interested. Another 5% asked White Castle to stop contacting them. So this is weird. I mean, it's just, look, Taco Bell's running out of 9-inch tortillas and sauce and ground beef and all the other stuff that we talked about yesterday. Restaurants and grocery stores are stockpiling food because the supply chain problems seem to be part of it. Not being able to get chlorine for your pool because it's just not available. And on it goes. And then the places that don't have enough people to work. It's just a strange thing. I've never seen anything like this before. But it's a great time to get a job. And the bucks are good. A lot of these jobs that you might expect to get paid a lot less for. What did we talk about, Cyrus? It was McDonald's, I think, and offering free tuition to complete your schooling and quite a bit more money.
Yeah, some major perks.
It really is amazing. I noticed that you, in your off hours, you're at McDonald's 4 to 5 hours a day.
You weren't supposed to tell anybody.
Yeah, okay. I'll keep your secret. It's safe with me. Let's go to Mary Helen in El Paso, Texas. Hi, Mary Helen.
Hi, Patrick. How delightful to talk to you.
Thank you.
I have a question about history, actually. The term Roman Catholic. There are some people that have such an objection to the term Roman Catholic because they say the church is Roman. It was co-opted by the Romans. I think Constantine is to blame. And so I want to know what the history is. When it was attached to the Catholic Church, who made it Roman Catholic and why?
Okay.
And so, then I'd like to know how to lessen the animosity of those toward the church because it's Roman.
Got it. Okay. Well, it's not a simple answer, so I'll try to give you a few of the highlights. Number one, the term Roman Catholic is often used nowadays by people who want to like really make it super clear that they're Catholic. You know, say, so I'm a Roman Catholic, as if that makes it more official or something like that. In my view, it's superfluous to say Roman Catholic. It's not necessary to say it. In fact, it can even be misleading for this reason. There's nothing inherently incorrect about it. The Roman Catholic Church is a legitimate designator. Even though it's not an official title of the Catholic Church or one that the Church claims for herself, it refers to itself as one holy, Catholic, and apostolic. I mean, those are terms that the Church uses in an official way. And it is Roman insofar as the Roman Rite of the Catholic Church is the predominant rite, and the Bishop of Rome is the head of the Catholic Church. So it is Roman in that sense, you could say. But it really gained ground at the time of the Protestant Reformation. So going back now about 500 years, and here's why. And this is not localized only to England, but England did play a major role in this, and that was when Henry VIII broke with the Catholic Church because he wanted a divorce, and the Pope would not grant it to him. And he proclaimed himself to be the new head of the new Church of England, and all the subjects of the realm were no longer now subject to the Pope in any religious sense. They were now subject to the crown, to the monarch. That was the beginning of an attempt on the part of the more high church, Church of England people, to style themselves as legitimate Catholics. They took the population of England and Ireland and eventually Scotland from one day being Catholic and having had been Catholic there for nigh unto 1,000 years. And then the next day, oh, you're no longer Catholic now, you're Anglican. So that caused a real mental dislocation for many people. And it was very jarring and difficult for them, as you might imagine. So once the Puritan era sort of came and went, and the Puritans, keep in mind, as Calvinists, were very hostile to anything Catholic in an historical sense. But once their influence began to wane, then the more liturgically oriented and more traditionally oriented folk began to rise back into positions of power in the Church of England. And this is where we see a theory propagated, which was that they are a form or a branch of the original Catholic Church, the ancient Catholic Church. And the Church of England styled itself as a kind of a via media, a middle way between the excesses or the extremes of the Roman Catholics on one end and the Protestants on the other. So they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. And so they began telling themselves, well, we're really Catholic also. We're not Roman Catholic, but we're Catholic, and we accept the ancient faith as it comes down to, you know, to us. And they paid lip service to Saint Anselm of Canterbury and Saint Augustine of Canterbury, not Saint Anselm, Saint Augustine of Canterbury. And they tried to establish a kind of living link in their church with the church of old. But that's impossible because they broke with the church definitively. And that's really where this term in the English-speaking world became popularized. It was to refer to Roman Catholics as a kind of subset or a sect within the bigger so-called Catholic Church that doesn't really exist. But that's how they looked at it. So really, that's what's behind that. Even though the average person who says, I'm a Roman Catholic, doesn't think about that. I'm sure that in good faith, somebody says, I'm a Roman Catholic, and they're not in any way trying to lessen the truth of the Catholicity of the Church. But ultimately, my personal view of this is to say Roman Catholic is entirely superfluous. You're just Catholic. And if you're Catholic, you belong to that one church established by Jesus, and we don't need the extra names to identify which one it is. I don't look down on anyone who says Roman Catholic, but I wish that they knew the history behind that term and how it's often used and understood or misunderstood. I hope that's helpful. Thank you for the call. Let's go now to Corey in the Twin Cities. Hi, Corey.
Hi. I had a comment about sure. What you were talking before with the technology. But in a good way, and the Holy Spirit kind of being the ultimate Siri. I was on my way back. I'd been displaced from my job and was having a hard time because I was in a very niche field. Mm-hmm. And I was on my way back from a third job interview and had turned on Relevant Radio and called into Drew Mariani for my friend's father, who was in really dire health. And Drew prayed for me as a listener and for whatever reason also mentioned jobs and prayed for everyone who was searching for a job. And a couple days later, I got the offer. So I feel like was a nice God wink and the Spirit, Holy Spirit working in a great way. And my friend's father recovered also. He was like at death's door. Now he's back worked on the golf course. So
that's wonderful.
It was a nice, happy thing.
That is great. So you got, did you get a better job, I hope?
I did. Got a better job, better pay, and have a wonderful Christian boss who on my first day took me out to lunch and asked if it was okay with me. She said grace over our food. And,
oh, that's great.
Which was the best part of the day. God found the perfect place for me. And I wanted to tell Cyrus, if, because my daughter is young, she just found a job at a golf course. So if you have one by you, they are always looking for people to wash carts and collect balls
there
and
you
take
go.
Out the trash.
A Caddyshack. Maybe Cyrus's son can be the Caddyshack guy.
That's a great idea.
There you go.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you, Corey. I'm happy for you. I really am. And you sound happy, too. Thanks for calling in today. Quick break. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Just for your good to know file, a defund the police figure. He's an advocate for the movement of defunding the police. Representative Cori Bush, Democrat of Missouri, very much on the far left. He's been all about defunding the police, but Federal Election Commission filings show that she spent more than $54,000 on what? On private security. Defund the police for all you people out there. You know, no police for you. We got to defund them. But she dipped into her campaign fund to the tune of over $54,000 to hire RS&T Security Consulting for security services. A cached version of the RS&T Security Consulting's website, which is offline now, shows the business provides, quote, executive protection agents for first-class executive protection and security for national and international figures. Our protection specialists are highly skilled in a multitude of armed and unarmed protective services. Surveillance systems, installations, and private investigative services. Our diverse close protection teams are trained, licensed personnel who are experts in the private and public sector in 136 cities throughout the United States. So that's good for her. I mean, I'm glad that she had the security. People with guns, don't you know? She also paid $15,000 to a Nathaniel Davis for security services around the same time. It's unclear who Davis is or what services he offered, although his address in the filings is the same as Bush's campaign headquarters. So I just wanted you to know that. You know, people who are like super into defunding the police are making sure that they spend whatever is necessary for themselves to have police, to have security. Just thought you might want to know that next time you hear somebody yammering on about defund the police. Let's go to Dan in Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Patrick. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
Listen, I want to get your opinion. The pastor of my parish, he asked me to lead a study group, and what I was thinking of doing it on was the presence of the Eucharist.
Okay.
I'm kind of looking for resources, books, websites, and so forth, especially in light of the finding where they say a number of Catholics don't believe in the real presence. They see it more symbolic. So I was looking for something maybe to kind of like bring home the point of how to show that it is the real presence, or how to prove it. If you know, if there's something you could recommend, I appreciate it.
I can recommend several things. Sure, one would be go to Lighthouse Catholic Media. I believe they are now subsumed into the Augustine Institute. So if you go to AugustineInstitute.org, I believe it is, you'd be able to find this repository of many, many, many talks on Catholic themes that are available for a price, but it's a small one, to download digitally, or you can get a CD, and they have many of them on the Holy Eucharist. So that would be one that you could do. I'm a big, big fan of the book, The Hidden Manna by Father James O'Connor. It's a classic in the field. It's perhaps the best book that I'm aware of, and I'm aware of a lot of books on this topic. It's the best one I've ever read, which gives a comprehensive overview of the history of the Eucharist, its biblical basis, what did the Church Fathers teach about it, what about at the Protestant Reformation. So there's so much there in one volume that I think you would find everything you're looking for there. Also, if you're interested in something a little more offbeat, I was invited or challenged to do a debate on one of my speaking lecture tours in Australia, and I was invited to debate a megachurch pastor in, yeah, take that back. This particular debate, now that I think about it, was in New Zealand. So I was in Auckland, New Zealand at this megachurch, and the pastor of the megachurch wanted to debate the Eucharist. So we did. And it's available as a digital download, which you can find on my website by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick and click the link for books, and you can navigate to where the digital downloads are. But anyway, so this was a debate on the Eucharist. And what was really cool about this was before the debate, the pastor I was debating told me that he reckoned that the majority of the people who were now his church parishioners were ex-Catholic. So it was a beautiful opportunity to be in this debate, to be speaking in front of an audience of hundreds and hundreds of ex-Catholics, and to be able to talk to them about the Eucharist in a way that I would guess they probably had never heard before. Maybe they never heard it quite that way. So if you'd like to hear how I approached that topic to a room full of ex-Catholics who were hostile to what I had to say that evening, you might want to check that out. And that one is called, I forget what that one is called. Maybe before the end of the show, I'll look it up and I'll be able to tell you what it was. But that's another one. If you poke around in there, you're going to see where it talks about the debate on the Eucharist. And then, of course, if you want something quick and easy that you can get your hands on right away, Catholic Answers has a beautiful selection of tracts that are available digitally. And some of those are on the Holy Eucharist, on what does the Bible say about this? What do the Church Fathers say about this? Not to mention many articles that were printed in This Rock magazine, and eventually the name changed to Catholic Answers magazine. If you do a search for Eucharist, you'll find magazine articles galore, and those are all free as well. I think that'll keep you busy for a while.
Yeah, I know the program we're thinking of using is Formed, and they have like different teachings, and one of them is on the presence of the Eucharist, P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking of using that.
Yeah, form.org is excellent, and it is a division of the Augustine Institute that I mentioned about the audios. Yeah, so I would highly recommend Formed. I've seen a good deal of it, and I've been impressed with it.
All right, Patrick, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You are welcome. I appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
888-914. Thank you. I will. 888-914-9149. I'm going to see if I can give you the title of that article, or I'm sorry, of that debate. Yeah, here it is. It's called Hold Fast to the Traditions Debate. So it was a debate about scripture and tradition. That was part of the debate. The other part of the debate, the main part, was about the Holy Eucharist. And that was the one that I did at this megachurch in Auckland, New Zealand, in front of all the ex-Catholics. So that's another resource for those who are interested. Some people say, well, debates, they don't work. Debates don't help anybody. I beg to differ. Of all the debates that I've been challenged to do, and I've done maybe about a dozen of them over the years, I don't like debates. I don't think I'm particularly good at debating, but sometimes it just seems like the right thing to do, to accept the challenge. So I've done it that number of times. But of all the debates that I've done, I do know of at least one person who I debated who actually did become Catholic. And it was at a church in just outside of Riverside, California. And we debated, I forget now what we debated. I think it was, you know, is the Catholic Church the true church or something like that. And he was like super hardcore against the Catholic Church. He was an ex-Catholic. And he really, really wanted to debate. And we did it in front of his church. I don't know, a couple hundred people were there. And it came and went. That was the end of it. I never really thought much about it after that. Well, years later, the gentleman's name was Lloyd. And years later, Lloyd contacted me. And he said, you know, I just want you to know I became Catholic. And I wrote back to him, like, what? And he said, yeah, I became Catholic. He says, it wasn't like immediately after the debate. And there were other things as well. But he says that that debate really kind of got my attention, and we were discussing things. He says, I was convinced that the Catholic Church and its teachings were false, and that's why I left the Catholic Church, he said. But when we had this debate, it really kind of turned me around and helped me see things from a different perspective. So He became a Catholic again. Thanks be to God. You know, this is all God's doing. But I've seen that happen. I've seen people, many, many, many people over the years who have heard certain debates, one in particular, a debate on Sola Scriptura that I did with a gentleman by the name of James White. It was back in 1993. And that's probably my favorite debate of all. And over the years, I can't tell you how many times people have sent me an email or told me in person that was listening to that debate that brought them into the Catholic Church or back to the Catholic Church, as the case may be. And in some cases, people who were deeply dedicated to this principle of Sola Scriptura, it was when they listened to that debate, and in some cases they had to listen to it more than once, that they began to realize that the truth was in a direction that they were not expecting. So don't be afraid of debates. They can be very helpful. They're not, if they're done properly, they're not about the conflict. It's not about the polemics. Although, if it's not handled carefully, it can devolve into that. That's for sure. But in general, if a debate is done properly and in the right spirit, it can yield great spiritual fruit. I'm thinking about the great Saint Augustine. During his polemical activities with the Donatists, for example, he was a great defender of the faith against several aberrant groups, including the Donatists. And it was known that he would publicly debate them. They would challenge him to a debate, and they'd line up in the public square, and they would debate him. And in more than one instance, the Donatist bishops who were there to debate Augustine, they said, okay, you win, we'll become Catholic. It was just that powerful. So don't be afraid of debates if they're done properly. Let's go to Elaine now in I hope I'm saying this right. Is it Otsego, Minnesota? Otsego?
Otsego.
Otsego. Okay.
Otsego, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Well, welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. I want your opinion. Earlier you were talking about how phones can pick up what you've said, and mm-hmm. I've seen that happen many times. And then you were also talking about priests having phones while they're in the confessional. So putting those two thoughts together, I'm wondering your opinion on, asking the priest not to have a phone in the confessional.
I don't think it's untoward to ask that, because you have a right to privacy. You have a right to anonymity, for that matter. And so if having a phone in the confessional could compromise that, you're not out of bounds for asking that the priest not have a phone. It's such a new thing now that I have a feeling that a lot of people would be taken by surprise if you ask them that, if you ask the priest that. But knowing what I know now, if I were a priest, I would not bring a phone into the confessional, and I certainly never bring the phone with me when I go in to confess my sins.
I never even thought about myself bringing it in, but that makes sense as well.
I'd like to think that would be, whoever was listening in on my confession, I'd like to think that I would be boring them to tears, but even still, I just don't, I don't want it, don't need it.
Exactly. I just want the confidentiality, obviously, of the confessional.
That's right. Yeah, you're most welcome. And just imagine if, let's say, law enforcement decided that they wanted to find out, let's say that there was a high-profile pro-life person, who was out there actively working to defend innocent human life. And they knew where she or he went to church, and they knew that she or he had a regular sacramental life. And so they decide that, the priest would never have to know. Just like the priest who was doing bad and immoral things, the priest who had to resign from the USCCB, he didn't know that this third party had figured out how to de-anonymize the data that was coming from his cell phone, publicly available stuff, and to de-anonymize the information that was coming from these immoral apps that he had on his phone. He didn't realize that this information was being aggregated in an entire chronological profile was being built about his activities. He only found out about it when it was already a done deal. And now he's gone. He's out of a job. So it wouldn't require that a parish priest, if we want to use that as an example, would even realize. He wouldn't even know that this was happening. But if they said, okay, we know Father McGillicuddy is the priest at this parish where this high-profile pro-life person goes to Mass and goes to confession. sooner or later, she's going to go to confession. And why don't we just do this technological wizardry and activate the microphone on his phone and let's see what we hear. Wouldn't that be interesting? I mean, this is the stuff of science fiction until just recently, because now it's real. And it has been for a while, but now we're realizing just how real it really is. Doris in North Providence, Rhode Island, thank you for calling.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Regarding the gentleman who was asking questions about convincing somebody about the Eucharist.
Yes.
And one of the resources I was thinking of was the book Eucharistic Miracles from Joanne Carol Cruz.
Yes.
And there's also another book that Joseph Carpenter wrote.
I should have remembered that one. I'm glad you reminded me. Joan Carol Cruz, Eucharistic Miracles. Excellent book. I'm glad you raised that, Doris. I'm out of time, but you just got in right under the wire. Joan Carol Cruz, Eucharistic Miracles. Excellent book on the Eucharist. Well, I've got to run, but I'll see you again in about 21 hours. Same Pat time, same Pat channel. Please pray for me, and I'll pray for you. God bless you.